Hello again to student teachers of NEMATA, those who are on the staff of the Sofianic School, as well as visitors to the campus who come to enjoy the many features that are available without charge and without obligation. This is none other than yours truly, recording on the 16th of December, in the early morning hours of a dark winter day in 2018. I'm taking this occasion to make an exceptional recording to introduce Course 7 in Poetic Craft. How is it exceptional? Well, I'm posting it on the landing page, which means that it's available to anyone who comes to the school. You don't have to be a member to go to any landing page, although you do have to be a member to access the units in the curricula associated with each course. I'm making an exception here by putting the introduction to the course on the landing page due to the particular nature of the material. And I can think of no better way to introduce you to the material, which concerns poetics and poetry, than by citing three or four lines from a poem entitled Poetry. This poem was written, I suppose, sometime in the 50s by Marianne Moore, who is a well-known American poet of the modernist tradition. I shall have some things to say in this course about the movement called modernism, which grew out of the late 19th century and exploded in the early 20th century and then crashed tragically, due to the horrific conditions that arose in Europe between the First and Second World Wars. The phenomenon, the creative, cultural, intellectual wave of modernism, is, in my opinion, an extremely important moment in the life of the European peoples. And when you learn a little about modernism through the units in this course, you might find yourself attracted to modernism. You might find that you identify it. Even though modernism is considered today to be passé and dead and completely out of style, well, that is a fact. It's an unfortunate fact. But it is not due to a fault or any fault of modernism itself, and it is not certainly not due to any fault of any poet, artist, painter, sculptor, dancer, playwright who belonged to the modernist movement. Modernism is an expression of the high cultural, intellectual and creative activity of the white races, and it has been trashed and thrown into the trash bin due to deliberate efforts in the war against the white races and against the Euro-American tradition as a whole. So I warn you about that. I advise you to take into your minds right now, without definition, the signal term of modernism. And to begin, or to introduce, Course 7, I offer you these lines from a modernist poet. I too dislike it. There are things that are important beyond all this fiddle. Reading it, however, with a perfect contempt for it, one discovers that there is in it, after all, a place for the genuine. Now, those are the opening lines of the poem called Poetry by Marianne Moore. And in those lines, she comes out with six guns blazing. She expresses a sentiment that she held, more than a sentiment, a notion, an opinion, a stance that she held toward poetry, which I most certainly share, and which I would suspect that many of you listening to me right now also share. I too dislike it. Notice that she does not write I, comma, to, comma, dislike it, which would be correct punctuation in terms of prose. I too dislike it. No, she says, I too dislike it. Can you see how emphatic that is and how it conveys to you that you are included in the I too? Well, I certainly do dislike most of what I encounter under the name of poetry. And to a certain extent, I even dislike the topic of poetry. I'm turned off by it. I'm not interested in learning anything about it. Well, how can I say that when I've devoted so much time in my life to teaching, to the study and teaching of poetry, all the way from the poetry of the Greek tragedies up forward to the poetry of medieval romances, to the troubadours, coming forward to the poetry of the 18th and 19th centuries, Russian poetry, and then, of course, the poetry of modernism coming into the 20th century, when the whole movement and the whole wave of poetic creative impulse in the white races crashed. Well, we live in a postmodernist era. We live in the time of where art is managed by Saatchi and Saatchi. And as long as art is managed by Saatchi and Saatchi, you can be damn sure that poetry and literature are also managed by the likes of Saatchi and Saatchi and that particular ethnic group who controls the publishing world and who tyrannizes academia. One of the reasons that you may dislike poetry is that you've never really had a chance to have a fresh meal prepared according to the high standards that some people, such as myself, hold. High standards regarding what is poetry and what is poetics. So I begin with this line in order to warn you that I am going to address what is most likely to be a natural dislike or disinclination you have toward poetry. Now, I want to make it clear that it's not my intention to persuade you away from that inclination, that disposition. You don't have the disposition to take an interest in poetry. Well, disposition is the mother of intent. So if you don't have the disposition, you're never going to find the intent. And you may happily and without guilt sign off this course. No problem whatsoever. But I do invite you to listen to what I'm going to say in the course of this recorded introduction. What I'm recording is more or less a straightforward reading of what I've written on the home page. Because Course 7 is an exception in certain respects to the curriculum, I have written a long introduction on the course landing page. So I'm going to read that and add here and there a few spontaneous comments. Note that I announce a dedication for this course, and I use the term verse and vision as a kind of meme to guide you into what this material is. Poetic craft is about verse and vision. It's not just about verse or vision, it's about verse and vision. This course is dedicated to Terry, as I knew him, as many people did. And that would be Carol F. Terrell, who died in November of 2003 in Maine, near Orono, at his house where he lived on the Stillwater River and where I visited him many times. Terry, who introduced me to Ezra Pound, who published my first piece of serious writing, and who transmitted to me the secret of poetic craft, the shape of the line. So one of my aims in this course is to transmit to you that secret, that technique, that single technique, which I received directly from Terry. So doing so, I would put you in a line of person to person and flesh and blood transmission. I would place you with myself in a line of flesh and blood transmission of modernism, of which Terry was a great exemplar in the tradition of Ezra Pound. I have designed Course 7 for those who don't like poetry or think they don't like it or prefer to ignore it without actually knowing what it is that they ignore and why. Some may even hold it in contempt. To those many who fit this profile, I propose to open with these lines from the poem of Marianne Moore, which I just cited. So I argue at the introduction that learning about poetry and poetics in this course is a way to locate a touchstone in your emotional field. Poetry is a touchstone of the genuine, of what is genuine in the mind and sensibility of the human animal, the human individual. And so the objective in these studies is not necessarily to write poetry or come to like poetry. I wouldn't put that on you. But certainly to appreciate how poetry is written, and in doing so, to be sensitized to the genuine, which of course stands outside poetry, although it is often, in the best cases, conveyed within poetry. Concluding that same poem, Marianne Moore wrote, quote, "If you demand on the one hand the raw material of poetry in all its rawness, and that which is, on the other hand, genuine, then you are interested in poetry." End quote. So what is the raw material of poetry? Well, it is your own sensibility and your feeling for language. Do you have a passion for language? Do you have a sense of responsibility regarding the way you use language? Do you feel satisfaction when you use language skillfully, when you state things in a lucid and attractive way? That is the raw material of poetry. It is the expression of language in concision, in precision. I know people who have written, I knew someone in Santa Fe, who wrote one absolutely perfect poem of about 10 lines. It was perfect, according to the rules of poetic craft and modernism. And this gentleman who attended my course on poetics in Santa Fe, way back then, actually realized the raw material of poetry and the genuine power of poetic expression by simply writing one poem. He couldn't write a second and a third. He couldn't write a series. But in that moment of writing that one poem, he achieved it. Any of you could be in the same situation. You might, for instance, write a three-line poem, a haiku, imitation of a Japanese form. And it might be the only poem that you ever write in your entire life. But in writing it, you would achieve something that is genuine. And in that way, you would see that what is genuine in poetry is the same as what is genuine in life itself. Taking this course, you may become interested in poetry or may not, but the value of taking the course stands on its own terms, as I use poetry like a pretext or a ploy to reveal something else, namely, the trigger of genius. Of course, it is primarily the magic of language, of the spoken and written word, that comes before examination here. That is the kind of magic that can, quote, present for inspection imaginary gardens with real toads in them, end quote. This is another line from Marianne Moore's poem. I would have to guess that after all is said and done, some people are simply not language prone, but operate more nonverbally, visually, pictorially, or musically, excluding the music of words. That's fine. And for those to whom that is the case, and there is no fundamental disposition to take an interest in poetry, then I simply advise passing on this course. Subheading, the shamanic angle. At first sight, the topic of poetry might appear to be an odd inclusion in the curriculum of Nemata. But once poetry is associated with the universal tradition of bards and folk singers, and by extension with shamanism, its relevance begins to become clear, I think. I personally believe that it would be a massive omission on the teacher's part to delve into shamanism without including an excursion into poetry and poetics. Consider the Tambo Kulinya, the Tan for short, spelled T-A-I-N. This is the principal legend in the Ulster cycle of Irish folk myth. Now, the Tan is a shamanic mystery tale clothed in the chaotic story of a cattle raid. Although it is written down in prose, it is a genuine remnant of the legacy of poetic bards who recited the folk memory of the peoples, of the clans. The key figure of the Tan is Queen Maeve, who reigns over Connacht, and this name itself is a deep slice from the lore of indigenous shamanism, the name Queen Maeve. The old Irish proper name, Maeve, derives from the Proto-Celtic medu, meaning mead or medua, intoxicating. The name is a title for the mead woman, or she who intoxicates. Hence, there is a direct parallel or correlate to the Grail Maiden of Arthurian legend. It's known, I'm interjecting here, that the Arthurian version or versions of the legend of the Holy Grail, and even Wolfram von Eschenbach's version, which is a German version, derive from certain elements and themes and images and memes in Celtic folklore. Ceridwen is the goddess of the mystical or magical cauldron of the underworld. The cauldron is a prototype of the chalice. What comes out of the cauldron is a potion, a dakini potion of intoxication, of mead. All of these themes are wound into a very tight spiral that focuses down into the figure of Queen Maeve. Although given to a human female, the name has been associated with the power of a sovereignty goddess. And that is scholarly jargon for a goddess figure who bonds the people to the place where they arise. In ancient and medieval Ireland, drinking mead, most likely a psychoactive potion, was part of the royal inauguration ritual, kingship rituals. In Celtic myth that forms the basis of Grail legend, as I just noted, a supernatural witch, Dakine Devata Fairy, bestows sovereignty of the land upon the king, and likewise inspiration upon the shamanic poet who drinks from her cup of mead. The Proto-Celtic Medwa means ruler and may refer to the fact that the candidate for kingship of a tribe had to qualify by undergoing an initiation ritual with the use of a psychoactive potion. So you see here, I'm delving quite deeply into the realm of shamanism and the realm of bardic poetic folklore, the genre of bardic poetic folklore associated with shamanism. Just to add a further note of clarification here, I think I've distinguished myself somewhat over the years when I've spoken of shamanism, and that's been a lot, to include, in some cases, the very great fact that the shamans were storytellers, and that one of the roles of a shaman was to access the phylogenetic memory circuits of the earth, the memorial chambers of goddess memory itself, and to recover the true unwritten history, sometimes stretching over millennia of time, the history of the people, of the tribe. That was a role and responsibility of a shaman, in addition to whatever else a shaman might do by way of healing, by way of transactions of power with the supernatural. So the shaman had a role in the social order of his or her time to sing and recount the story of the species. Well, the story of the clan, now the role of the shaman today, the Guyan shaman, is to recount the role of the entire species, going back to the origin of the Anthropos at the galactic core. And this ability to access the phylogenetic memory circuits of the Anthropos, I called initially shamanic recall. Now, returning to the text on the course landing page, passage in the Tawn recounts the encounter between Queen Maeve and Fedelma, a witch known for her ability to see the future. And here are the lines describing that encounter in the form of a Q&A. I am Fedelma, and I am a woman poet of Connacht. Where do you come from? Maeve asked. From learning verse and vision in Alba, the girl said. Do you have the light of primal seeing? Maeve asked. Yes, I have, the girl said. Now scholars translate the Gaelic, don't know how to pronounce it, Imbas Porosnai, as light of foresight. Imbas meaning foresight or intuition. This translation reminds me of the routine translation of pronoia among Gnostic scholars. They translate pronoia as foreknowing or providence, though intuition would be a more accurate term. So I translate Imbas as intuition. So Imbas Forosne is the gift of clairvoyant or clairaudient apprehension of the natural and supernatural worlds. It is the primary mark of the visionary ability of poets of ancient Ireland and many other cultures and lands. Hence, the poet had to be a shaman, but not necessarily every shaman was a poet. In short, Imbas Porosne was mantique, divinatory skill. Now, the old Irish imbas means inner knowing or inspiration, and that was the divine gift of the fili. Probably it's not pronounced that way, because very few Irish words are pronounced in the way that they're spelled, and the way that they're spelled is a gobbledygook. The divine gift of the visionary poets, which were also called Olaf, or Olam in Irish, and Skald in Scandinavian lore. There are dozens of names unique or particular to different cultures describing the shaman poet. The word Forosine, your guess how to pronounce it, means illuminated or that which illuminates, and it contains an allusion to phos and phosphor, meaning light or light holder. The Gnostic masters were honorifically called phosphors. You find that word in the Nag Hammadi writings. Illumined ones, phosphors. The witch Fidelma is a guide to the other world, gifted with a shamanic power to shift back and forth between the natural and supernatural worlds. Notice her subtle response to the question of Queen Maeve, where do you come from? She does not come merely from a literal place, somewhere in Ireland or Scotland actually, but, quote, from learning verse and vision in Alba. Well, what place is Alba? Well, that word is the Gaelic name for Scotland. So, Fidelma is a Scottish witch, but responding as a witch, she answers in a dual tongue, Idris style. Alba is Scotland in the natural world, but it is also white land, the whiteness, in the supernatural. Alba derives from an Indo-European root meaning just that, white. Hence the term for England that eventually came to be associated with England, Albion. Albion is a derivative of Alba, and it means the realm of whiteness. In short, Fidelma confesses to acquiring verse and vision from instruction by the light, the method of the mysteries. So I said it was a deep cut. Here I feature for an illustration from Wikipedia the coronation of King Alexander III on Moot Hill, Scone in Scotland, which is dated to the 13th of July, 1249. On his right is the Olamhraig, the royal poet, who addresses him with this proclamation containing the word Albane, meaning Scotland. Consistent with the role of a guardian of folk memory, the poet shaman pictured here then recites to the king the genealogy of the king. That is to say, the poet shaman receives the king and proclaims him to be king by reciting from the record of phylogenetic memory. This instance, this one instance out of many I could cite, illustrates how deep the roots of poetry actually go. They go into the genuine folkloric memory of the many races of the Anthropos. And although the traces of those memories have now been largely destroyed due to a deliberate attack upon the Anthropos, and although the traces of those races, even the traces of those races, are hanging in tatters, nevertheless, the root force is still there to be retrieved and recovered. And poetry is one way to find your way back to that root force. You do it through the language endowment of your own birthright, whether it be French, German, English, Welsh, Irish, Scottish, Scandinavian, Icelandic, Finnish. You do it through reconnecting to the root language of the nation and people into which you were born. Subheading, tour guide. The landscape of poetry today could better be called a landfill. For some time now, as will be explained in the blocks of this course, poetry of the genuine sort, crafted poetry, has been buried under heaps of garbage talk, such as slam poetry, rap, and gangster rap, to mention the most obvious examples of the egregious corruption of the spoken word in our time. Although I will indicate what happened to poetry around the time of the Black Mountain Cult in the 1950s, this course does not require getting to know a lot about poets or a lot about the course and the downfall of genuine poetry in the 20th century. I have set it up so that you only have to get to know one poet, and that one will be your guide, alongside of myself, to the entire realm of modern poetry and poetics. Your guide for Course 7 will be Ramon Guthrie. In the famous tale of composition of the Divine Comedy, Dante's guide was the radiant Beatrice, and she is typical of the mystic woman who inspires the male poet, the poet's muse. She was a variation of the classical muse, also known in another culture as the beautiful lady, as she was recognized among the Russian symbolist poets such as Bielli and Bloch. Note, the word that identifies the genre or school is symbolist, not symbolic. They were the symbolist poets, and that movement in Russia, to which I'll dedicate a block, was a parallel to modernism in Europe and America. Yes, there is a block on Russian poetry. So here I am reversing the gender roles, and I'm making Ramon Guthrie the Beatrice-like guide on your tour of the spiraling worlds of modern poetry. The only required reading that I propose, I do not impose, is Maximum Security Ward, which is a beautiful example of the poetic craft that I will be disclosing. There you have a photograph of the late Romantic Ramon Guthrie, painted in Paris in 1928 by Stella Bowen. Now, M.L. Rosenthal, Masha, that was a man, who perhaps sits in the Zenosh Hall of Honor, was a close and longtime colleague of Terry's. And Terry spoke to me often of M.L. Rosenthal and of attending conferences where he spoke on the platform with Rosenthal. Now you're looking here at world-class scholars of modernism, Pound, the Romantic tradition, language studies. Rosenthal was one of the few scholars of high esteem who championed the work of Ramon Guthrie, who was otherwise regarded as a lesser or marginal poet of the 20th century. One scholar, Germain Brie, wrote of Asbestos Phoenix, which was the final collection of Guthrie's poems, that it, quote, alone would place Ramon Guthrie among the major poets of the mid-century, end quote. Well, certainly, I place Ramon Guthrie among the major poets of the entire 20th century. His masterpiece, which is called Maximum Security Ward, eventually gained critical acclaim, due in large measure to M.L. Rosenthal promoting it. Another modern critic, Malcolm Cowley, noted, quote, among the talented writers I've known, the most curiously neglected is a poet and scholar, Ramon Guthrie. He started out with the famous writers of World War I generation, Hemingway, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, and others, some of whom were his good friends. His best writing was on a level with theirs. End quote. So I'm giving you these scholarly details simply to raise in your minds the profile of Roman Guthrie, whom I've chosen as your guide to Course 7. And it gives me pleasure to point out that Guthrie was a lesser-known, marginal, and, let's say, unrecognized poet. He was an outsider and a marginal figure, yet I bring him to the center of the topic. So, in short, Guthrie is an outsider for academia, but for these studies, he is the ultimate insider and the main informant. As the content creator of Course 7, I can guarantee you that if you make the effort to know Guthrie, both the man and his poetry, and accept him as a guide, you will not need to know anything else about modern poetry and poetics. So I invite you to take a moment and just sit back and reflect on that statement that I'm making here. It's an outrageous statement, and it remains to be seen if I can deliver on that statement, but I'm totally confident that I can, and with pleasure. So to reiterate, because it's such an important point leading in here, if you make the effort to know Guthrie, the man, consider his poetry, how it is crafted, and accept him as the guide to this course, you will not need to investigate any other poet. If you get what I'm putting together behind Guthrie, by knowing only that one poet, you can know just about all that is required to appreciate poetry in depth, whether or not you like to read it or choose ever to write it. So there you have it, and that's my outrageous claim, and it pleases me greatly to make it. So I would add, before going on to the final page and a half of what's written on the landing page of this course, I might add that who knows what might happen from taking this course. For instance, there might be someone out there hearing my words right now, be you of the male or female gender, who really doesn't care for poetry. And doesn't, if I say to you, name one poet that you like or you ever heard of, or name three poets, or name five poets who have engaged you and enriched your life, you probably would not be able to name anyone. But consider this wonderful possibility. Sometime in the future, you who dislike poetry, if you were asked about it, if someone said, well, do you ever read any poetry or take any interest in it? You could say, no, I don't know anything about it, but I do know Ramon Guthrie. And you would nail it right there. This is an introductory course in appreciating and writing poetry. It is derived from a one-month spring block I taught at Prescott College, Arizona, way back in the twilight years of the 20th century. The 20th century. So I constructed the bare bones of this course under the presiding presence of Thumb Butte, and you see it pictured there on a postcard from Prescott, overlooking the small, typically southwestern town of Prescott. I have extensively modified the content and structure of the units to fit Nemeta, but the basic outline of the course remains as it was presented, and here are the six components from the original outline. The genetic word, read or recite, the poetic current, the crisis of modernism, aspects of composition, poetry liberated. So, these six components, the leading themes of the course, won't be presented to you in a linear sequence. They work more as a tapestry of threads in which each component comes to be revealed here and there in the development of the units. Back to the subject of suggested reading. I do draw upon numerous examples of poetry throughout the course. I don't rub your face in it too much, Don't worry about that. At Prescott College, the required reading was maximum security ward, as it is here. That, at least, is my strong preference. Maximum security ward, you will find in the Persia edition. And that edition, by the way, was launched by M.L. Rosenthal with the aim of raising recognition of Guthrie's achievement. So Maximum Security Ward is the name of the longest poem in the book, but there are also shorter poems which exemplify various aspects of Guthrie's writing. Maximum Security Ward is one of perhaps, what do I cite? I don't know, maybe 15 examples of a particular genre of modernist poetry, which is called, by Rosenthal, the modern poetic sequence. I call it the open sequence. So one of the things that you'll learn in this course is what is the open sequence? And I will cite many examples of it. For instance, probably the most well-known example of the open sequence in the modernist movement was The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. Aha! Aha! Well, isn't that curious? It just so happens that the landmark poem that everyone must learn at the university, representing this achievement, the open sequence, has a title taken from the Grail legend, and it reiterates in the poem in several places. T.S. Eliot reworks themes and motifs from the Arthurian matter, such as the Fisher King. The Fisher King is a theme in The Wasteland, and The Wasteland itself is the English translation of the old French La Terre Gaste, the wasted land, which is a reference to the plight of the Grail family. So even if you don't know anything about the Grail family, and you don't have the Grail Gnostic connection working in your syntax, when you go to university and you're required to study modernist poetry, that's the first thing that comes up. So I am pitching these blocks with a shamanic spin so that the material resonates with the mysteries, the Grail legend, Mantique, and other prominent themes of Nemeta. And I am offering the late romantic and self-styled troubadour, Ramon Guthrie, as your guide. Finally, final remarks. To write or not to write. Course 7 in Nemeta requires no formal acquaintance with the subject matter or any particular knowledge of modern poetry, who wrote it, how it is crafted, and so forth. However, the contrast to poetry that is not crafted is a big distinction, and one of the main points that I want to get across to you in this course. Whatever else you get out of it or not, that has to be in the takeaway. You will never look at poetry in the same way again. If you pick up a book of poetry by random on the table of someone's house, or if you come across some lines of poetry or what is said to be poetry on the internet, you will immediately see whether it is crafted or not. This course is not intended to teach the writing of poetry. Rather, it does something more comprehensive that will catch the attention of those who are not inclined to write poetry, perhaps due to lacking the impulse or the confidence to do so. Poetic craft goes one better than teaching how to write poetry. It teaches how poetry is written. So good poetry, authentic poetry, crafted poetry. The leading assumption is poetry is not really genuine unless it is crafted. You will certainly be surprised to find out what crafted means. So at the conclusion of the text, I wrote something, tried to write something about giving a comparison. My aim here is comparable, say, to describing how a bicycle is designed and constructed. That could be really interesting to you, even if you don't want to build bicycles, or even if you don't want to ride one. Likewise, you could learn something from going into a gourmet kitchen and observing how a certain meal is prepared. You might not necessarily want to become a gourmet cook, and you might not even want to eat that particular meal. Nevertheless, it's inherent to the human animal to be fascinated by how things are done, isn't it? I'm deeply interested in how many things are done. And by learning how something is done, you have a genuine relationship to it. Do you see where I'm going? What is genuine is revealed when you see how things are done. And you see how wood is chopped and stacked properly. Even if you don't do it yourself, you then have a genuine relationship to the chopping and stacking of wood. You see my point? Unfortunately, it's impossible to have a genuine relationship to IT and everything concerned with, what is it called? The science of information, after Claude Shannon. When you use your cursor to block a text and then copy and paste it into another document, you cannot have a genuine experience with the computer tool you're using to do that because you don't know how it's done. How is it done? How do code writers write a code that allows them, for example, to create an application that prints words in italics or translates one paragraph of text into a different language? What kind of code do they use at that level in the chip that allows you, by the click of a mouse, to convert a paragraph of words from English into French? You don't know how that's done. Therefore, you can never have a genuine relationship to the technology through which it is done. That is a very great fact, and that is an extremely unfortunate condition today, considering that we are led to believe that you can't live one moment of your life without the assistance of archonic devices, whose operations shall remain forever mysterious to you. On the contrary, in the case of poetry and poetics, you go back to the root power of language, which you carry in your own body. How do you produce words when you say a sentence? How do you produce those words out of your body? Well, you know that there's air that comes out of your lungs. It vibrates the cords in the larynx or the sound box. Somehow those sounds come out of your mouth, depending on the way you move your tongue, depending on your jaw structure. All of that is material. All of that is genuine, not only because you have direct experience of it, but also because you can place yourself at the source of the living word. And that, I would say, as a summary, is the final takeaway of Course 7 in Nemata. I, too, dislike it. There are things that are important beyond all this fiddle. Reading it, however, with a perfect contempt for it, one discovers that there is in it, after all, a place for the genuine.